Hi, my name is Sam Blizzard. Welcome to Comms from the Shed, the interview show where you get to hear from a range of diverse and interesting voices on how they've coped during the global pandemic. In this series, we'll be taking an informal look at life, talking to people who've been doing incredible things, and asking them about their hopes for the future in both their personal and professional lives. Hope you enjoy it. Joining me today, I have Dr. Kirsty Fairclough. Kirsty is a reader in screen studies at the School of Digital Arts at Manchester Metropolitan University. She's chair of the board at the Manchester Jazz Festival and also board member at the Digital City Festival. She's an academic with over 20 years of research, teaching and leadership experience. She's lectured at New York University, the Royal College of Music in Stockholm, and also Columbia College in Chicago, to name three. Her writing is featured in no less than six books on popular culture, and she recently appeared on a TV documentary talking about the music of the 1980s. Kirsty, whew, that's quite a career. Welcome. It's great to have you on Comms from the Shed. Can I just ask, where did the love of academia come from?
Well, first of all, thank you, Sam, for inviting me onto the podcast. I'm delighted to be here and speaking to you. That's an interesting question because I actually was very interested in performance when I was much younger. I did a degree in performance and in media production, actually. But what I found was I actually preferred the critical analysis rather than the actual performance itself. So I'd like to deconstruct a performance rather than actually perform. So that was kind of where my my interest kind of split. So I was all set, I want to act, etc. Then I realized that actually I much prefer the kind of critical deconstruction of film and of theater, etc. So yeah, that was where it all started.
Can I ask when that kind of transition happened? I mean, did you act for a while? Did you kind of, were you an active participant in the arts before you moved into that more kind of theoretical side?
Yeah, I got into academia when I was very, very young. I think I was 21 when I first started lecturing, which seems ridiculous now. So I was at Edinburgh Festival I used to go every year with various shows. I was there for the whole summer with a show back in, goodness me, 1997. My goodness, I never even, I rarely look back, so it's crazy to talk about this. So yeah, and then I had a phone call so I'd graduated that summer. I was in Edinburgh. I had a phone call from someone I used to know and lecture at the university, who said, would you fancy doing a little bit of seminar kind of coordination and leading some discussions? So I did, and that was it. I was absolutely hooked on academia there and then. So I didn't really have I wasn't even in the industry in terms of acting. I was straight into academia before I even knew it, and have been in it ever since and absolutely love it. It's a joy and a privilege to do this job.
You know, it's great to hear you say that. I'm also a massive fan of the Edinburgh Festival Fringe and the arts. And funnily enough, I used to volunteer in the summer in Edinburgh to work for free. And part of the payoff was, yeah, wow, you would get shows to, get tickets to the shows. I remember doing a thing called Festival Absolutely. Radio. And actually, the interviews I did then, 20 plus years ago, are very similar to a lot of the interviews I do now. So that was a fantastic experience.
Oh my goodness, the Fringe, yeah, amazing. I used to spend every, the whole month. And it was really interesting because I've been with, literally no budget shows, which, in itself is an experience, as you probably know. Then I've also been to Edinburgh with people like Peter Kay and Russell Brand in a previous life. So, I've kind of seen both sides of it. And, the assembly rooms, which I'm sure you remember, and the whole kind of the entire comedy industry would decamp from London to Edinburgh. And those were just absolutely crazy days, but they were fantastic. They really were.
You're bringing back memories now. I remember interviewing the slightly off the wall comedian and magician Jerry Sadowitz in the assembly rooms bar.
Oh my God. He was a huge hit in Edinburgh every single year, wasn't he?
He absolutely was. And he was a really interesting character, sort of off camera, if you like. I saw a different side to him when I interviewed him. And I wish I still had an audio transcript of that interview, because it was one of the funniest things I think I've ever experienced. Now, you are currently involved in so many different projects, and I just wanted to ask you about a couple of them. for the benefit of our listeners. First of all, can I just ask you what the Digital City Festival is? How would you kind of describe it and sum that up? Because I know that's something that you're heavily involved in.
Yeah. So I'm on the board steering group of Digital City Festival, which is a festival that showcases all things creative, digital and tech within Manchester and the region, if you like, the Northwest. So last year was the first year and it was held in person. You know, it was the last event that I went to. And it's really to showcase the fantastic expertise that we have in Manchester and beyond, as I've said, in those sectors. And it's really about showcasing that and providing a sort of global platform for it. So this year it will be all online. So there's some exciting plans afoot for that festival. So that will take place from, I think it's something like the 12th of April for 2 weeks. So there's loads and loads of content being created at the moment, which is very exciting.
That is very exciting. And I think I saw something that you'd responded to on LinkedIn or perhaps on social media. And it was a comment, I think, from someone in the BBC about how COVID has opened our eyes to the virtual event experience. And when you reflect on the last sort of 12 months, how would you say our view of events has changed and also virtual events has changed?
I've got kind of direct experience of this, and so many of us have. One, I'm setting up on the leadership team of a new school of digital arts. So the whole idea of pivoting to the digital has been so front and center for me. But also in terms of Manchester Jazz Festival, and it's the Manchester's longest running music festival. And we were pretty ready to go last year with our 25th anniversary. And then we had to turn the entire festival online in a very short space of time, which was extremely stressful, but extremely rewarding at the same time. And now I think we expect that notion of hybridity, don't we? This has been, in some ways, it's closed so many gaps. We're so much more able to speak to people that we perhaps wouldn't have been able to in the past. That idea that, when we come out of COVID, that there will be an online event coupled with the in-person event. So that I think that's an expectation now, certainly from people I'm talking to in arts and culture and the digital sectors, that, there should be both, and that is where things are going. And I think the School of Digital Arts, which I'm sure we'll come on to later, is very, very well placed to be able to support that.
I noticed as well on the list of books, one of which I've read, by the way, which we'll come on to later. One of those which I haven't got around to reading, which looks fascinating, is I think it's called The Arena Concert: Music, Mass Media, and Entertainment. Mm-hmm. What are your views on that now? I mean, based on what we've just kind of talked about, because I do agree it is definitely a modern phenomenon.
Yeah.
And it's a really kind of shared mass experience.
Yeah, I mean, that book was really the first critical assessment of the notion of an arena concert and what that actually means in terms of a mass shared experience, the catharsis of that. It was analysis of the kind of architecture of arena concert spaces. So it almost feels like we need to reissue it. We need to update that book and reissue it, because now the notion of what a shared experience is. Recently I was on a panel with Lost Horizon Festival, the online, the literally immersive experience of a festival that was at Shangri-La in Glastonbury. And obviously that now has taken off. They've had an amazing kind of traction with it. So the idea that you can go to a festival via an immersive experience, and what that means and how that changes the notion of that, shared experience. I don't think anything, I have to say, will ever replace that live experience, though, when it comes to music, ever. But I can see where there is a place for the immersive, using new technologies or relatively new technologies to enhance it. But for me, it's that there's nothing like it.
There certainly isn't. And in case I forget to ask you this question later, I mean, being a lover of the arts and music and live music, are there any kind of concerts that you've attended pre-COVID, obviously, that you would consider particularly memorable? Are there any that stand in your mind?
Oh, I've been really, really lucky, because I've been in a position where I've been able to go to, so many, and had a often quite a backstage experiences as well, which has put me in a really, you know, I've been incredibly lucky. So I was there at, do you remember Live 8, which was in 2005, the kind of sequel to Live Aid. And that I was there backstage throughout all of that. And it was absolutely incredible. Some of those moments there were just unbelievable. But of course, and this is probably coming as no surprise, all of Prince's concerts. So I saw Prince 12 times and no one could ever come close to him as a live performer. No one.
Well, I have to say, I think you know I'm a self-confessed Prince fan anyway. So, but I will come back. I will come back to the purple one later on. But that's great to hear about that Live Aid experience. I'm gonna ask you, because there's so much to get through. You're involved in so many different things, and I noticed as well that you mentioned the 3i Inclusive International Innovation Event. On a lot of your sort of posts online, could you just tell us a little bit about what that is and why it matters?
Yeah, so that is I've just been asked to speak at that event. So it's organised by UKRI and it's to showcase female entrepreneurs and people who are working in innovation, in digital and creative and tech. And particularly at the panel I'm on is the session I'm on is hospitality and events. So it's about kind of showcasing latest innovations and kind of matching female innovators in creative, digital and tech and entrepreneurs with potential collaborators. So yeah, it's really great to be a part of that, and especially with International Women's Day coming up very, very soon. So yeah, I'm thrilled to be involved, and I'll be talking about all things soda.
You mentioned International Women's Day, of course, which I think everybody in the world of communication and media are always very tuned into. And in terms of your own inspirations, I noticed that you're also involved in an event called Amplify Her, which is to do with female musicians in Brazil. And I wondered if you could just talk a little bit about that event as well.
Yeah, so we've just secured GCRF, which is the Global Challenges Research Fund. So we've received some funding through a call through the university to work with 12 female musicians in Brazil to help support them in the promotion of themselves as artists, because there's some real kind of disparities in certain parts of Brazil around the idea of female musicians and being out there in the industry. And I'm really, really, really thrilled to be a part of that. So it's a pilot project. So we're starting work on that now. And hopefully it will lead to other other projects that will really help to support some of those musicians in those parts of the world.
Excellent. And I must also ask you about books, because you are involved either as a contributor or a publisher or as an editor in numerous books, and I just kind of wondered how that came about, and you know, do you have a particular love of books, because that's a whole discipline in its own right, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And as an academic, you know, it's what I live and breathe. And you know, as academics, we are, of course, you know, we're researchers. That's what we do. We write, we think, we create, we publish. It's a kind of part and parcel of the everyday. So I've been really, you know, it's been wonderful to kind of work with some amazing collaborators. And the first book that we did was the music documentary book, which is, gosh, almost a decade old. And I was thinking the other day, we need a new one, actually, because there's so many other great documentaries now to analyze. But yeah, it's I usually work with a kind of group of collaborators, and we come up with some ideas and think about some gaps in, you know, in knowledge and what hasn't been written about yet and how we can kind of, you know, contribute to the field. So yeah, that's for me is a huge love. And I'm working at the moment on a book on which came out of a film season that I co-curated at home in Manchester. So that's called Pop Stars on Film. So we're looking at the notion of how the pop star translate or doesn't translate to a cinematic space, and how that can go work well or not so well, and to think about that in kind of global context and in kind of different cinematic market, film markets, essentially. So that's, we're working on that one at the moment. I'm also working on another one called Diva, which is looking at the idea of the diva within kind of, and linked with ideas about feminism within R&B and hip hop. So there's four of us working on that book at the moment. So hopefully that'll be out by the end of the year. So yeah, analysing people like Aaliyah, looking at people like Nena Cherry, Grace Jones, Beyonce, Mariah Carey, that notion of the diva within that particular genre, and how that has kind of translated to, again, to a kind of global context.
I think that last book sounds fantastic. I remember I seen a Beyonce concert at the O2, actually. Yeah. I think I seem to remember she got a zip wire from one side of the O2 to the other to do a little kind of mini set on a stage. But
I mean, why wouldn't you?
Going extra well. Absolutely. You? But that book sounds fantastic. I look forward to reading that when it comes out. Now I'm gonna make a damning admission to you now, Kirsty, which is that you may find this hard to believe, but I've never seen an episode of there's a noise in the background there. I'll ask this question again.
Somebody at my door.
That's okay. Do you need to get the door?
This is what happens in COVID times, right? Wouldn't be right, would it, unless there's a knock at the door.
I was just about to reveal to you the incredible fact that I've never seen an episode of the program Mad Men. You might find that hard to believe. So when I, obviously it in itself was a bit of a cultural phenomenon and a widely watched and loved program. As your book is about the legacy of Mad Men, just for my own benefit and interest, what would you say the legacy of Mad Men is? How would you sum that up?
That book came out of a conference that I co-convened with a partner in Tennessee. So we held the most. It was literally like a fantastic event, if I do say so myself, mainly because of Middle Tennessee State University, not me. But we had an opening academic party where everybody was dressed in Mad Men gear, the cocktails, the whole kind of thing was of the era. It was just fabulous. So the book came out of that. And what it does is looks at this idea of the how Mad Men can actually speak to the current moment, as well as obviously we know where it kind of adds new perspectives to the legacy of it, if you like. So it also it talks about the Trump era and how you can kind of map some of the sense of what Mad Men was trying to do upon what's happening now or what's just recently happened, if you like. It's quite a nuanced set of essays in that look at the depiction of a really complex decade. Obviously, that's what Mad Men did, and it kind of brings it up to date in terms of looking at the cultural importance of it now. I'm really proud of that book, and we had some fantastic writers in it. It does look at it through a set of different lenses, if you like. Worth watching the series.
No, absolutely. I think I will. I have license to go and revisit it now, or just visit it for the first time.
Yeah, because it plays with that idea of, what is quality television, and you know what, and how Mad Men's legacy kind of fits into that idea of what quality television is, because it's often talked about in those terms that it has. You know, it is a television show that had a significant impact on the kind of zeitgeist and the cultural landscape, you know, depicting that particular area, the late 50s, early 60s, but how it can easily be transposed to what's going on at the moment. So that's kind of the overview.
No, that's excellent. And I think you're absolutely right. I think that, you know, from what you've said, there are definite parallels with what's going on now. It's always, in terms of progression, it always seems like two steps forward, one step back. I want to just go back, because part of the idea behind Comms from the Shed is about us having the opportunity to reflect just on this period. We've all worked in different careers, but we found ourselves working from home 100% of the time for 12 to 14 months now, in actual fact. And this podcast is an attempt to allow people to sort of share some of their feelings and reflections about that, but also talk about how creative they've been in the period. What, Kirsty, what would you say are the biggest challenges you've faced into during the last 12 months, either professionally or personally?
Gosh, I mean, I don't think I've even processed last March, never mind, you know, anything since. But, you know, I'm in a very lucky position in that I can work from home. So I do recognise that privilege 100%. I think as a single parent, I found the homeschooling and working full time at a very intense pace extremely challenging, as have many, many people and many of my colleagues. You know, you're now, you know, you're living at work essentially now, aren't you? You know, there's that, there isn't really a separation. And I think it's important to ensure that, I'm sure, you know, we've heard this so many times, so it's nothing people don't know, but that idea of having those small rituals or ways of coping, of ways of, you know, whether it is just going for a walk at lunchtime for 10 minutes, whether it is meditating for 10 minutes, whether it is baking banana bread, which I did unsuccessfully several times, but I tried, you know, it is those kind of, you know, just trying to put something in your day that kind of separates this insane kind of, yeah, intense time. And yeah, homeschooling as well has been a particular challenge, but many people can relate, I'm sure.
Oh, absolutely. Definitely. I think my reflection on homeschooling is that I have two daughters and they literally haven't asked for my help once, which is both concerning and slightly upsetting. But I think it's symptomatic of the fact that they are a generation that have Google on tap and they have their friends in sort of discussion groups on their mobile phones as well, which is it's very 21st century. I know the pandemic is hit arts and education very hard, and in terms of support for students and also the creative talent we have in the UK, what work are you most proud of that you've been involved in recent months?
Yeah, well, I moved jobs in the pandemic, so it's been a very strange experience for me because I haven't yet met any of my colleagues in person. So integrating into a new team and seeing the way that team have worked incredibly hard in a new university to support students, you know, both in my previous university and my current one, has been incredible because, you know, just the anxiety that not only students, that staff are feeling, and the way that everyone has really, really rallied around to support each other and to support students makes me really, really proud to be, a member of the academic community. These are extremely difficult and remain extremely difficult times, and teaching online is very, very different and very, very hard and takes its toll on everyone. And yeah, so seeing that in particular, and also being part of setting up a new school completely remotely, it's been crazy to be a part of, but absolutely amazing. Just something positive to focus on has been great. But, you know, there've been some really difficult times, particularly for arts and for Manchester Jazz. You know, we've found this has been a difficult, extremely difficult period and continues to be, and we're certainly not out of it yet. There's a long way to go, and the way that I don't want to get too political, but I'm sure, you know, my view is probably no surprise to you, that the way that the arts have been treated, I think initially and in some respects continue to be treated in this country, has been shocking and disappointing. But we have a way forward, and I think we will, yeah, we'll come back stronger, I hope.
Yeah, absolutely. I'd echo those sentiments, and I sincerely hope that's the case. And you mentioned the school there that you're setting up. Can you just tell us a little, firstly, what is the school, and can you tell us a little bit more about that project?
Absolutely. So the School of Digital Arts is a £35 million investment between Greater Manchester Combined Authority and Manchester Met. And essentially what we're set up to do is to kind of plug that digital skills pipeline. So we teach all across a whole range of subjects, and we're very interdisciplinary, so from photography, filmmaking, games art, UX, animations, a whole kind of range of courses that we'll be teaching, and we open our doors in September, so the building is nearly there, which is amazing. And we're headed up by a fabulous advisory group, which is co-chaired by Danny Boyle, the filmmaker, I'm sure many people will know, and by Nicola Schindler, who is, I'm sure many people will also know Nicola, an amazing drama producer, produced some of, you know, the UK's best and well-known dramas. And people on that group from Apple, Channel 4, Universal Music, some amazing creatives like Jen Nakiru, who just made Beyoncé's Black is King or one of those pieces. So, yeah, we've got some fantastic support from the industry. We're really, really excited to get SODA's doors open. So we're all set to do that in September. We teach courses from foundation degree all the way up to PhD. We've got an amazing set of researchers that I'm working with at the moment because I lead on research and knowledge exchange. So doing some fantastic work, a recent project, we won £1 million Innovate UK grant to work with a SME called Forever Holdings. And we created a project called Audience with a Hero. So we work with the musician Nile Rodgers to create a sort of digital synthetic avatar version of him that we prototype, so you can have a conversation with Nile. And he was amazing to work with, so that you can, we could use that potentially for album releases. All kinds of things. So yeah, the Nile Rodgers project has just been absolutely brilliant to see it kind of come to fruition. So yeah, there's some really exciting research going on, particularly in AI, looking at algorithms and bias, VR, immersive particularly, but the whole of the school is hinged around this idea of future storytelling. So telling stories through new technologies. So that's really what SODA is about and SODA's mission. So yeah, it's really, it's just been brilliant to focus on something really positive in this horrible time. So yeah, I think, everyone says, oh, you made a move at the right time. And, you know, perhaps I did. Sometimes the universe works in funny ways.
No, absolutely. And having read Nile Rodgers' autobiography, I'd certainly like to have a conversation with him at some point, because he's a fascinating individual and obviously extremely influential in the world of music. I just wanted to ask you, reflecting on some of the things you said there and talked very passionately about, I previously worked for a construction firm called Lang Ruark, and they were involved in a project in Manchester called The Factory. I know is about future provision for the arts. Do you think that Manchester is going through a kind of either a sort of cultural or sort of economic sort of renaissance? I just wondered what your views on that were, as being someone who's obviously so important to the area there.
Well, it's the greatest city in the world, in my opinion, and I've travelled a lot. It is. Yes, I know what you mean about it. I don't think it's a cultural renaissance. I think, Manchester's cultural scene has always been extremely rich. It's just a fantastic, the amount of kind of music and theatre and all the kind of, cultural elements that kind of emerge from that beautiful city that we live in. Well, I live in. In terms of a kind of a renaissance, I don't know if it's a renaissance, but in terms of the boom, in terms of the creative, digital and tech sector, we are in a really, really strong position. A lot of investment going into Manchester at the moment. You know, School of Digital Arts is all part of that kind of that ecosystem. So I think we're in a really, really good place. Obviously, COVID's, put the city back somewhat, as it has with every city. But I think Manchester is extremely resilient as a, someone who's born and bred here. We've been through a lot in a lot of different ways, and it's been, there's been some really tough times, but what we seem to have in this city, and I am kind of, stereotyping an entire city here, but there is that sense that, we do bounce back from difficult times, and that sense of resilience is very, very strong within the city. So I've got no doubt that, post-COVID, there are going to be some fantastic parties for one going on in Manchester.
Oh, absolutely. And I think we are, well, I think we're trying to look to the future. I'm somebody who, I don't want to get too drawn in, because there have been a few false starts, but obviously we're all kind of hopeful and optimistic for a period later this year or even next year or the year beyond, where we are living something like a normal life again. I mean, if the world could return to normal right now, where would you be going later today if you could choose any place and you were completely free and you had any option that you wanted?
That's interesting. Where would I go? Oh, I'd definitely, I'd go to, I'd go into the city, go into Manchester, and I'd, mooch around like many of us do and go to our favourite restaurants and go and watch something at home, just do the normal stuff, just be involved in the the cultural scene, and just and the amazing kind of hospitality scene in Manchester as well. We've got some fantastic restaurants. So yeah, I just have a little mooch around my favourite city, and that would make me happy. Can't wait to do that again.
Now, I on episode one of Comms from the Shed, I shared an unusual sort of fact about myself. Now, is there something unusual about you that people listening would be unlikely to know?
Oh, that's a question. I don't know. I don't know. It's a tricky one. Where shall I start? Maybe that I was cut out of. I was on a Phoenix Nights, and I'll never forgive Peter Kay that he cut me out. And I'm on the deleted scenes. There's that. I was also in 24 Hour Party People. Very brave, very briefly, literally see my hair. I think that's it. And what else? I'm a roller skater, and perhaps people don't know that.
Yeah, I've got to ask about the Peter Kay thing now that you've brought it up. What was the scene that you were due to be in, and what was the particular piece that was cut out?
Yeah, so I was walking into the club, and Max and Paddy, well, Paddy was on the door. I think I had two lines. And didn't make it, but I'm on the deleted scene somewhere. But I went to, I've known Peter Kay for a long time, long time. So yeah, I remember that was, I was gutted. But I got over it, just.
Oh, that's excellent. I think we're all going to be sort of scrabbling through the DVD extras of Phoenix Nights now to see if we can catch you in that deleted scene.
Thanks, Sam, but I'm not sure anyone is that interested, but
we did talk about Prince earlier, and I must come back to talk about Prince briefly, just not least because he both when he was alive and now since his sort of passing, is kind of a cultural phenomenon in his own right. And I know that you've been involved in various events, both in the US and in the UK, but also about a book looking at sort of Prince from a critical perspective. Are you surprised that there's been so much interest in him since his kind of passing? And are there more kind of critical studies of his work due to come out in the near future?
I'm not surprised at all, but I was when he passed. I was surprised at the lack of critical engagement with his work. So, hence, I kind of thought I need to host a conference on Prince, because if I don't do it, someone else will. So I collaborated with, again, one of my colleagues at Middle Tennessee State University, Professor Mike Alleen, and basically put the idea to him, and he was like, yes, let's do this. So the conference that I ran in 2017 was the world's first interdisciplinary conference on the life and legacy of Prince. So it was based in Salford when I was at Salford University. It engaged the city council, various cultural partners. It was amazing how people got involved, because it was, if you're running an academic conference on a cultural icon, you're going to engage with the fandom as well. So we made sure that we really did that, and we reached out, and we had Des Dickerson over, who lives in Nashville now, who came and did a keynote for us. It was a wonderful experience, and from that it's just snowballed. So we have a kind of international group of scholars now that I work closely with. So the book came out from that conference. It came out last year. We have another conference taking place this June. It should have been last June in Minneapolis, sadly not to be. So it's this conference that I'm hosting with Mike is called 78 to 88. So it's looking at the first decade and how Prince established himself within the Minneapolis scene and then internationally. So it's really kind of doing a kind of, very deep dive into that first decade of his work. And I've spoken at several other Prince conferences since. So one of my colleagues, D'Angela Duff, who is based at New York University, runs a number of symposia on Prince. And I'm speaking at one at the end of this month, which is called 1 + 1 + 1 = 3. So it's looking at Diamonds and Pearls, Rainbow Children and Controversy. So that's going to be fantastic. So that's all going to be, a real weekend of real Prince, critical analysis from some brilliant scholars who are absolutely fantastic. So yes, it's definitely snowballed in terms of the Prince scholarship community, and I've had the absolute honor of being able to go to Minneapolis a number of times now. It is a bit surreal being a kind of I was a young kid who was just obsessed with Prince, and then I get many years later picked up by Prince's cousin from the, you know, at the airport. It's just been a crazy, crazy experience, but absolutely wonderful. And yeah, I do feel like, yeah, we're raising the profile of Prince scholarship. And people say, why do you do it? Why do you analyze someone who's not here anymore? But, you know, he's thinking about his legacy in terms of the way that he used new technologies, the way that he, you know, railed against the internet in so many ways, but then embraced it as well. And his position in terms of representation of race, gender, sexuality, what he was doing back then was years ahead of so many others. So, you know, trailblazer in so many ways, and very important to kind of keep his legacy alive. So yeah, it's a real privilege to be a part of that. And it's been a really interesting journey over the last 3 and a bit years.
No, it sounds like it. It sounds fascinating. And obviously Prince generated an incredible body of work, just, you know, just a phenomenal amount of music and concerts, and like you say, multimedia experience. And in terms of the actual kind of experiences, the actual sort of contact you had with Prince when he was alive, are there any memorable kind of moments that really sort of stick in your mind, either a concert or a recording, certain experiences that meant a lot to you? Because it's obviously something you're very passionate about.
Yeah, I mean, I did see him at the Manchester Academy, which is a really small venue, and seeing him that close was just, were you there?
Yeah, I'm so glad you said that. I was there. Wasn't it part of the Manchester University, or it was a small square room, wasn't it? I'm getting excited now, because I didn't realise we were both at that concert. But well, sorry, but you talk and then I'll reflect.
Yeah. I mean, just that. I mean, I've seen him in other venues, many others, but I saw him at Manchester Apollo once, and that was amazing because he kind of walked up the aisle and I was on the end, so I just managed to just, you know, my hand touched his cape or whatever he was wearing at the time. So that was a highlight.
A purple cape.
Yeah, exactly. Seeing him at the Academy in that small space was just unbelievable. Yeah, that was mind-blowing, because, you know, you're used to seeing him, well, I've been used to seeing him in big venues, and being that close and that kind of intimate performance. And I have seen so many artists, and no one comes close to his performance level. No one. It was, yeah, I'm sure you've got views on it, but it was a really, really special experience.
Well, I'm going to share something about it. It was an incredible experience. Prince at the time was, rightly, I think, from my point of view, getting quite annoyed about people holding mobile phones in there. And interestingly, the reason I mention this is because there was a lot of security and a lot of checks that you had to go through to get into that show. Which was very surreal anyway, because we queued, I think we were queuing outside Manchester University. I remember queuing along the street. It was almost like going into university halls or something to see Prince. It really was quite surreal. But a friend of mine who's actually from Stockport originally, who, big music fan, but he'd never seen Prince in concert. And I was trying to persuade him to come, and we drove up from London to Manchester to see that show, and it was just surreal. When we first got into the venue, I mean, as you know, it's a very small, as I mentioned, just a very small square room, but there was a mic stand with Prince's symbol on the front of it. There was this gold kind of symbol, and my friend Martin turned to me and he said, this is almost like a kind of wind up, like someone's just mocked up that microphone stand, plonked it in this little room. And it's clearly Prince is not going to come and perform here, you know. But it really was quite an incredible show. And I saw Prince quite a few times, and you know, the performance level was extraordinary. And I do feel it's a shame for people who maybe wanted to see Prince but never got the opportunity, because those of us that did certainly became hooked on the music and the magic, you know. Like you, I've written quite a lot on him in the past, and I'm sure we will all continue to do that to keep his legacy alive. So it's great to share that with you. And he was one of the greatest artists of his generation. I don't think there's any question on that.
Yeah.
And just to finish off with a couple of questions, Kirsty. Firstly, what could other industries, do you think, learn from the arts in this sort of period of adversity? Are there things that you've seen and that people are doing that others could learn from?
I think it's that notion of adaptability, isn't it? And, you know, the thinking that allows you to pivot very, very quickly, or to think about different ways of your output, of your creativity getting out into the world. So I think I've seen that time and time again with a lot of creatives over the last year, just being able to really to pivot in ways that have produced new and exciting work, really. So yeah, I think that idea of adaptability is really important.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I'd just like to close with a question, which is, you know, you've talked about a lot of the exciting projects that you're involved in, from events to books and other things. But what are your sort of hopes for the future, just in terms of the next few months? What would you like to kind of achieve this year?
Well, I think it's, you know, I'm particularly hopeful that the Manchester will get back on its feet in terms of the cultural scene, and of course that SODA will open its doors and welcome people, and, you know, be a really, really important part of the kind of, you know, cultural, digital and tech ecosystem in Manchester. So for me, those are the things I'm really focused on. And for Manchester Jazz, which I'm chair of that festival, we're already kind of coming up with new ways of being able to get that music out there. So definitely watch this space on the Manchester Jazz front.
That sounds great. And I think all sort of music lovers will definitely take an interest in that. I wanted to say thank you for your time. I know how incredibly busy you are from having talked to you off mic and off camera. So thank you for being so generous with your time. I feel like we probably need to do a separate podcast just on Prince, to be perfectly honest with you. So maybe we'll talk about that. I think that would be great. Maybe the live concert experience, something like that. Yeah. But for the time being, thank you so much for talking to Comms from the Shed and sharing your experiences these last few months. And yes, I wish you every success in everything you do. And I would encourage all of our listeners to keep tabs on all these great projects you're involved in. So thanks very much for your time today, Kirsty.
Thank you, Sam. It's been an absolute pleasure talking to you.
Well, thanks, Kirsty. Bye for now.